My name is Mari and I'm an alcoholic.
And
I'm just so delighted to be here. My dry date is the 10th of August 1984. My group is the Markham Village Group in Markham, Ontario. I have a sponsor and I sponsor, and I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous and truly, truly grateful to be so. I would like to thank you for inviting me here. I'd like to thank John so much, Presbyterian John.
I'm going to say John anyway.
for picking me up at the airport and taking me for a lovely meal and then driving me faster than a speeding bullet. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And you know, I was born, and you probably hear that I'm not from Canada. I ended up in Canada the same way that Columbus discovered America. I was looking for someplace else. But I am very grateful to Canada because that's where I found sobriety. You know, I'm 35 years sober, and I'm 76 years old, and if you were to ask me how all this miracle happened to me, how come I happen to be standing here even tonight, I don't know. I just know that it must be some miraculous gift of grace to somebody as undeserving of me as me, is the only reason why I'm here, because I should not be here. Because I was telling my story, there's no road here from where I'm coming from. There's no road from living on Lincoln Road on Miami Beach to here. There's just no road. And how grateful I am, and will continue to be as long as I breathe, because AA has given me everything that I have in life today, everything. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. I'm an Irish Scot, you know, part Irish, part Scots. What that really means is that half of me wants to drink all the time and the other half doesn't want to pay for it. And that was the story of my life, you know. You know, I was born into a good family, a good Roman Catholic family. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. My father had been a Franciscan monk, and he left the monastery because of some religious dispute. It wasn't an ill repute, he just left because of some doctrinal dispute he had. And he went off into the war, and he was a very brave man. He was in Dunkirk, and my mother's two brothers were both killed in the war. And I came from a family that was service-oriented, service to country, service to God. Never be angry about anything that happens, and none of it rubbed off on me. None of it. You know, I was taught nothing except how to be good, and I just have no ability for it. I have a never-ending capacity to be bad, and I don't know why. Even today, you know, if I see a purse, I'll think, that looks good, and then I'll... So, from a very early age, I just didn't feel I fit in my family. I didn't feel I belonged. I used to think too much. My old grandfather, who was a weekend drunk, I used to see him on a Sunday morning before we go to church. He'd be sitting holding his head, and I said to him, what are you thinking about? He said, I'm pondering the immensities. And I was to ponder the immensities until I almost disappeared into my navel, thinking about things. I was always thinking about things. And then I, at a very early age too, because I felt so different, and I was bullied because I was really weird. And I just get into lying, cheating and stealing at a very early age, because it seemed to me that if you had something I wanted, I would take it and you could live without it, thank you very much, and then I'll help you look for it. And I did that very young. I didn't learn that in here. I learned that way back then. And my family didn't know what to do with me, And then at about 13, I developed panic attacks. If you read Bill Wilson's life story, you will see that when he was about 17, when Bertha died, he went into his first panic attack. I had my first panic attack at age 13. No drugs, no alcohol, just my mind. Panic attack. And then I got absolutely obsessed with death, totally and completely obsessed with death. And I did not like people. I did not like anybody being around me. I began to be a bit violent, believe it or not. I look like a nice person today, but because of all the stuff I had going on, I felt I had to protect myself all the time. And eventually at 15, I got kicked out of school because a nun hit me, and I figured she could, if she could give it, she could take it. And I got kicked out of school, and here I am, you know, I'm not well, you know. I'm just, you know, what I'm trying to say to you is that my family, everybody around me, and me, always knew there was something seriously wrong with me. Because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with me. And I did not know what it was, and I did not know that the solution to my problem was alcohol. Alcohol was the solution to my problem. Alcohol would give me the promises. I'd know a new freedom and a new happiness. It would do all of that for me. But I never wanted to drink, because coming from a Celtic background, there's a lot of alcoholism. No, I mean, my grandfather, I'd say, was weekend alcoholic, but was never in the home. They always went out to drink and then would stagger back home, and the women weren't drunks. I'm the only woman alcoholic there ever was in my family, but a lot of male alcoholics, a lot of them. And who do you tell when you're obsessed with death and when you're having panic attacks and that you're just, you know, who do you tell? There's nobody to tell. And it's such an interior journey. And you get absolutely trapped in self. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and read that I have to get out of self, I thought, oh my God, that's the solution. Because I was trapped in self. And I was trapped in these obsessions of the mind. And God didn't make any sense to me. I threw him away long ago. I remember my first date. At 15, I was out on my first date. And at the end of the night, this guy, you know, like they do in Scotland, they think at the end of a night they should get a reward. And he's there being very passionate with me, and I'm there not really involved. I'm too busy thinking about myself. Actually, I've been married 4 times and never been involved, really, because that's been the problem. And you know, and I remember at the height of his passion, whatever it was, I don't know, I said to him, so what do you think about death? You see, I was seeking understanding. I was seeking to find if there was anybody who was like me. And it was not until I was 12-step to age 40 by a Métis. And a Métis in Canada is a Native American French. That is a man at 28 years sobriety who 12-stepped me. And for the first time in my life at age 40, here is a man talking the language of my heart. Talking about things that I thought nobody else ever suffered from or thought about. It's an amazing thing, but I didn't come here till I was 40. And I had a long journey. And I decided my mother was so ashamed of me. My first job, I got fired because they weren't paying me enough. So I decided to cook the books and just to give myself a little extra money, and they brought in an auditor, and they always spoil it, these auditors, and I got fired from that job. And you know, I was breaking my mother's heart, and I had one little brother. He was a sweet little... You know, my mother always wanted Shirley Temple. Way back in the day when I was born, Shirley Temple, well, she got me. You know, she didn't get a little blonde, blue-eyed, she got me. But she got Shirley Temple 6 years later when my brother was born. Yeah. And he's been tap dancing his way through everything. And I love my brother. He's such a good boy. And then at 17 and a half, I decided I was going to make my mother proud. I went into nursing. It was not a good career choice. I don't like blood. I'm obsessed with death. And I don't want to touch skin. So it was not a good career choice. And I got out of there and I thought, you know what? I'm going to take myself away. Because not just my family. See, that's the thing with me. I will be somewhere for a while. I will create so much chaos that in the end I have to leave. And you know what you don't understand is that everywhere you go, you take yourself along. Everywhere you go, you take yourself along. I went down to London, England, and I got a job with British Airways, first of all on the ground, and then at age 21 I went into uniform, which really sounds ridiculous because I'm claustrophobic, I'm obsessed with death, and I don't like people. And I was always kind of pushing a bullet, you know, just pushing a bullet to see how far I could go. And I'm up in a plane and it was not good. And then I thought, what the hell's going to happen to me? What's wrong with me? I would run around London, England in the 60s. Great place to be, you know. I would go and I would see The Who and I would see The Beatles and I would see The Stones and I would see people taking drugs and drinking. And I thought, if I take any of that, I'm going to go completely nuts. If I touch any of that stuff, I will go completely nuts. So I thought, what can you do? You know, how are you going to survive the rest of your life? Get married. You know, I'm always having these wonderful light bulbs. So I got married. I married a really nice guy. He came from an old rum family. Well, you know, in Jamaica. He was in London, England. Compliments of his parents' money. And we met. We fell in love. And he took me back to Jamaica. And in Jamaica, I had everything that money could buy. I never wanted for anything. And after a year, my first son was born. And just after that child was born, I thought I was truly going to go insane. I found out later, they said I was probably going into postpartum psychosis, but I don't know what it was, but it was certainly going into something, and it was a horrendous experience. I can recall minutely to this moment, utter and complete loss of control of the mind and the body. And they brought a doctor and he wanted to give me an injection, and a friend of mine was there and said, give her a drink. And Jamaica has 151 proof rum. Yeah. Isn't it lovely? And I just knew after the 1, 2, 3 drinks, however many drinks they gave me that day, that every little thing was going to be all right. I just knew that. I had found my solution, my magical elixir. And I drank every day from that day. Didn't drink copious amounts, I just drank every day. And after about 4 years, my second son was born. I drank every day I carried that child, I'm ashamed to say. But by that time, quickly, 4 years, I had lost the power of choice and drink. I never thought about it harming him. I just knew that I had to drink. You see, I felt the solution to my madness, this is just my idea, okay, that I'm sharing with you. I truly believe for me that alcohol prevented me from going into full-blown psychosis. That is what I believe. And when I drank, for some reason, it created a chemical psychosis. That's what I believe. I went from one to the other. So that, because you see, up until I drank, the world was beginning, no matter how much I loved that baby, and I loved that baby from my toes to my soul to my heart, but the world was beginning to just look grey and frightening to me. And I have a few little drinks, and all of a sudden, it's lovely. And I hated people. I didn't like them. And all of a sudden, I have a few little drinks. Hello, how are you, BFF? The whole world changes. What is that? It's not reality. There's nothing different from grey to technicolor, except my perception. And it's like my sponsor says, alcoholism is a disease of perception. I believe that. I change my perception. And that's why life becomes bearable for me. And so by 4 years, the cucumber had become a pickle. And my husband didn't know what to do with me, and I was crazy. And I was somebody asked me to tell it, so I'll tell it. I keep saying this is the last time I'm ever going to tell this joke. It's not even a joke. Okay, I used to live across the road from Bob Marley. And Bob Marley didn't like me. And I didn't like Bob. I didn't like Bob because he was a pothead. And he didn't like me because I was an alcoholic. And alcohol is against the Rastafarian religion. And Bob's record producer had given him a beautiful old great house. It's a gorgeous old house just across the road from me. And I could see him, and he used to feed all the poor people and take care of the poor people. And he was such a humanitarian. And I'd puff on this thing all day. And he had a BMW, and I had a BMW. And one day I'm in the garage, and I'm waiting for them to fill up my BMW. And I'm standing there with my cigarette holder, kind of swaying in the breeze, thinking about myself. And Bob drives in his BMW, and he shouted at me. He shouted out my name. And he said to me, you think you're so smart drinking your blah, blah, alcohol? And I said to him, I'm known to have some intellect, you know. And he said, if you think you're so smart, what does BMW stand for? I said, Bavarian Motor Works. He says, no, man, it means Bob Marley and the Wailers. Bob Marley was a humanitarian. I was totally and utterly encased in self. Totally and utterly. I had examples all around me of how to behave, and I didn't have the capacity for it because I was trapped one more time in myself. I had gone from being trapped in myself as a young person, drinking, getting relief. Alcohol took me out of self. That was the great beauty of it. Few drinks and I'm completely out of self. And now all of a sudden I'm trapped back inside self again. Only this time I'm suffering from a strange thing called the phenomenon of craving. And I don't know what the hell that is. People used to say to me, Mari, when you drink you're a moron. Why don't you just have one? Okay. And I'd have one and I couldn't stop. And I'd feel ashamed. I'd feel guilt. How come I can't just have one drink? How come when I have one drink and they're all looking at me, watching me, then I run away and drink a bottle by myself when I get home? That brings a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. And then my behavior got very bad. And then I decided I wanted to leave my husband. He didn't expect it. Is that heavenly music, or am I not hearing that? So, my children were 9 and 5, and I divorced my husband, left the island. And a man said, let's get married, I'll take you to Canada. And I love getting married. I've been married with alarming regularity. And here's what happens to me. I fall in love, and him and I are like Velcro. And then we'll get married. And then after about 3 weeks, I can hear him breathing three doors down. Did he always breathe like that? Of course, the problem is not him, the problem is me. The problem is always me. But you see, I will always try and be a victim. I will always try and find somebody else to blame. You're breathing too hard. I want a divorce. It's not good for my nerves. I don't like the way you eat your soup. It's too traumatic for me. And so in Canada, I sent that good man away, and by this time I'm shaking so much I can't get my drink up, and I've got my two little boys there. They have nobody else in Canada but me. I love these little boys. I never physically abuse my children, but I'm a hopeless alcoholic mother, and my children saw things that no innocent child should ever see. And I got a job as a pharmaceutical rep, and because I had a Valium deficiency. And so then I got on Valium, Librium, and Chlorohydrate. That's passive. That makes you passive. And, not many thoughts going on there. And I'd drive drunk with my children in the car. I didn't mean to do it. I'd go out just, I'd say to them, I'm going for milk nooks because I wanted to go and get a bottle. And I'd just pop into a bar for one drink, pass out, wake up on the floor. A man would take me home. My sons would wake up through the night and I wouldn't know they'd woken up. And the next day they'd say, Mommy, who was that man that was here last night? And I'd say, there was no man. You were dreaming. You were dreaming. I had my children question their reality. By the grace of God, here's what happened, so they could be saved. I decided to go back to Jamaica. And the children's father said he would have them for a week. He was married again and had a newborn baby. And my son had written to his dad telling him all about me. My 11-year-old had to do that. No 11-year-old should have to do that. He said to save his little brother and save himself. And my ex-husband told me I wasn't getting my children back. I tried to kill myself. First of many attempts. And two bottles of rum, two bottles of 151 proof rum, and two bottles of Valium, enough to kill a horse. I don't know how much of that I took. But somebody found me who shouldn't have found me, because nobody knew where I was. I'd rented this little house. I'd locked myself in there to die. And, you know, we don't die easy, alcoholics. You know, when I hear alcoholics say, if I drink again, I'll be dead, I say, you wish. You wish. Some of us live forever drinking. Forever. What dies is the spirit. It's the spirit that dies. And they saw me pumped on my stomach, and I woke up and I was so angry at being alive. And then I can't even bother to tell you, but I was living in an old rundown hotel in Kingston. One day my husband saw me coming out, my ex-husband saw me coming out in not good shape and out of the hotel, and he came and gave me the 2 years back child support he owed me and told me if I didn't leave the island he'd kill me. And left Jamaica, went to Miami. I didn't know anybody. I got a little apartment and I started to drink myself to death. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't know, I couldn't live without my children. When my children were taken away, a hopeless drunk like I was, and all my bad behavior, but it was like somebody unplugged me from life. They pulled out the plug and there was nothing left of life. And my heart is still scarred from losing my children. my beautiful little boys. And I'd drink Passo, come to. I couldn't kill myself drinking. I couldn't die. Tried. Terrible. I got kicked out of the apartment for non-payment of rent eventually, and ended up on the street. And my life on the street was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. And you have no femininity left. You have no humanity left. You are taken up and used and thrown away like an old piece of cloth. An old piece of used cloth. And there's nothing left, and there's no hope. There's no hope. And this old woman, God, you know, Bill and Bob had a poem they loved called The Hound of Heaven, written by Francis Thompson. And it's about this man who was essentially, I think, I know he was a drug addict. And he was running through life, the drug-filled life. And he kept hearing these footsteps behind him, like a dog chasing him. And he called it God. One day God just stopped him and confronted him. And he said, God was like a hound of heaven. He just kept running after me until he cornered me and had me stop and turn around. And it's to me, it's like God has always been that hound of heaven behind me. Because an old woman came, and she's an old English woman that used to live in Jamaica, and she now lived in Fort Lauderdale. And I asked her for money. And she told me that she'd met my family when they came to Jamaica. She said they were looking for me because my father had died. Apparently my father got up one morning at 3 o'clock in the morning and said to my mother, I don't know where my lassie is, and I don't know where my grandchildren are. I'm going for a walk, and dropped dead in the street. At the same time I was living on the street. Some connection there. Because you see, nobody knew where I was. I was too ashamed to tell anybody. Nobody knew where I was. So she contacted my family. They came and they wept when they saw me and cleaned me up. And I couldn't go back and face my mother, so I went to Canada. In Canada, I had a friend there and got married. This guy thought he could... This is dreadful. I don't even remember getting married. I don't remember. I know I did. I got the people. But I don't remember what happened. And he was a nice man. He's the man that got me to AA, really. Him and a psychiatrist. Anyway, I started, you know, I don't know what happened to me, but when I drink, I want to kill men. Not my fault. I don't know why. So I would attack John with various instruments. And eventually he became really afraid and took me to a psychiatrist who admitted me. And I had 4 years in and out the institutions, treated as a manic depressive and on lithium. And various other drugs, and I drank on everything. I even drank on antabuse, and that's a trip, let me tell you. That's a trip. Anybody in here drank on antabuse? There you go. And we live to tell the tale. We should be dead. Yeah. Nothing will stop us but God. God. Anyway, here's what happened. So they used to bring AA meetings into that institution. And Dr. Milliken, my psychiatrist, said to me, I think we've misdiagnosed you. I think you're really a chronic alcoholic. I think you have an abnormal personality as well, for sure. And that's how he said it. I mean, like, you know. You know, you have an abnormal personality and you're depressive, for sure. You can be very depressing. And he said, he said, but you do have your moments. He said, do you remember when you came down and told me you'd buy the hospital if I ever get into trouble? No, I don't remember that. He's making that stuff up. And anyway, he sent me to AA meetings. I never heard much because I was in so much medication, but something must have stuck. Thank God for the people who do the service to take the meetings into the institutions. Oh my God. You know, thank you. Thank you for coming into the nut ward. Because most of the people in there are alcoholics. Because alcoholism looks like another major psychiatric illness. Because guess what, people? We're not right in the head. Right? It's not just stop having a little drinky poo. You know, it's like deep, deep neurosis. We're here because we're not all there. That's just a fact. And when I got discharged from there, I'm sitting drinking myself sober, and I picked up the phone and I phoned AA, and that's when Stan came, the Metty, and 12-stepped me. You know, they have a, I think it was Scott Fitzgerald who wrote, who was, you know, he was an alcoholic, of course, and he said that in the real dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. You notice that real dark night of the soul when it's always 3 o'clock in the morning, because it's a soul sickness. And funny, it was 3 o'clock in the morning when Stan came to me. Yeah, and I hear it was 3 o'clock in the morning when my father went walking. And Stan 12-stepped me, and I got into AA, and I got very active in AA, and I got a sponsor. And here's the thing, though, I didn't want to do I didn't want to follow instruction very well. And you know, that is, recovery from alcoholism depends on, you know, being teachable, you know, and I mean, having structure and accountability in your life, that's what we need, you know. And then of course the steps, but they told me, don't have your kids come, and I said, I need to see my kids, I'm 4 months sober. And I arranged for my family from Scotland, my two aunts, to come to Canada. They spoke to the father, he sent my two kids. We had 5 beautiful weeks together. My little boy saw me sober. And then my aunts went back a day before my sons, and the day before my sons were to go back, I sent them out to get a video, and I drank a bottle of vodka. And they came home and found me lying drunk and screaming at them for leaving me. And some AA people came, and they took them to the airport the next day, and I was along as well. And that night, a little girl from AA spent the night with me, and the next day she said to me, I'm going to leave you now because you're a loser. My sponsor said, you're a loser, and I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the 3rd step prayer. And I said to her, I kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. And what I thought about was not what had happened just yesterday. I got a vision in my mind of the previous Christmas, when it was all arranged that I go to Jamaica to see my children. And all their Christmas presents, they were so excited. Mommy, Mommy, we hear you had another nervous breakdown. Yeah, but I'm okay now, I'm sober. Well, I wasn't, but I said that. And I went, I took, determined not to drink, to see my little boys. I was going to have them in a hotel for a week. Their father would come and check on me to make sure I wasn't drinking. Somebody would bring them to the airport in Kingston. And I got on the plane in Edmonton and changed planes in Toronto and bought a bottle of vodka. And between Toronto and Kingston, Jamaica, I drank that bottle of vodka. And when I got off the plane in Kingston, my two little boys were there shouting, Mommy, Mommy. And I dropped down drunk at their feet. And I remember lying on the ground and watching them being led away, looking over their shoulder at me with the eyes of the child of the alcoholic, the broken promises and broken dreams one more time. And that's what I thought about that morning. And it's because a similar thing had just happened the night before. And I knelt down and something in me broke. And maybe it was a level of despair that I just couldn't take anymore, and it cracked. And I said the 3rd step prayer to a God I didn't believe in. And from that moment to this, I've had no desire for a drink. some unmerited gift of grace was given to me, and I am so grateful to God and to Bill and Bob for whatever brought about this marvellous transformation, this journey that we have. And I got very active in AA. I got good sponsorship. I did a fourth and fifth when I was 6 weeks sober, because I hated it. I had so much stuff in here, I had to get it out. I did many others from there. I've always had good sponsorship. I started making all my amends, no holds barred, whatever you want. I won't even tell you a couple of them. I was just too anxious, and my wording was not good, and I might have left more offence than I meant, but my intention was good. And it was great, and I went to live in Toronto, and I got a sponsor called Greenie, who died with 53 years sobriety. And she taught me how to be the lady my mother always wanted me to be. She said, this is a sacred place here. This is the cathedral of the spirit. And you have to honor it. And I got married in AA. Didn't work, but eventually he had a massive stroke and I looked after him. And then I had to go back to Jamaica because my sons were put out at their father's house. My sponsor, Renee, said, I want you to go back. It's time for you to go back to Jamaica and make amends to the island. My sons were staying with their old grandma, and she always loved me, so I went and stayed there too. And one of my sons wanted to go to Scotland, the other one wanted to go to Broward Community College in Florida, and I was able to arrange that for them. And I stayed for 2 years in Jamaica, and I worked with the poor people down there, and I also got active in AA. There's not a lot of strong AA down there, unfortunately. And I'd, Clancy began sponsoring me, and I owe Clancy my life, because there was times when I was so afraid. I was so afraid, and he became my rock, and he's just always been able to give me just two or three sentences to set my crazy head straight again. And then I went back to Canada, and my sons eventually came, and we all lived together in a lovely little house until they started driving me crazy, and I sent them off to be self-supporting through their own contributions. And my youngest son got married in full Scottish dress and danced with me to a tune called Mama. And my eldest son, he said, Mom, Daddy's coming up from Jamaica. Will you come and walk me down the aisle, you and Daddy? And I spoke to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, and she said, yes, you will. And I'll have someone there watching to make sure you behave well. I mean, I made amends to my first husband, but I didn't like him. Don't have to like him, right? Just love him, right? Anyway, so when I saw him, he hadn't seen me for many years, and he's there with his two children who've just come from finishing school in Switzerland. And he said to me, my God, look at you. We never thought you could change. We thought a leopard couldn't change its spots. This AA has worked miracles on you. And I'm there with my AA stance, you know, my AA Madonna. Bless you, you know, bless you. You're looking really well. Your wife looks wonderful. Your girls are gorgeous and so intelligent. And inside I'm thinking, 20 years ago I hired two gunmen to shoot you, man. You were almost toast, my friend. But I behave well. I have five little grandchildren today, and they've never once smelled alcohol in my breath. And they love me. And they call me and tell me how much they love me. And I remember when my eldest was young, she used to call me and say, Sean, Ma, I love you more than fresh vegetables. And I thought, look at the innocence. I'm so grateful to God for this life I've been given. I'm so grateful for this transformation that has taken place. Despite me, because of good sponsorship, because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous over and over and over again, because of this wonderful loving God. You know, I've gone from having no God to have in what it says in your big book about how the consciousness of the presence of God will become the greatest fact of your life today. There's only 5 times in this program, in my 35 years of sobriety, I have felt a panic attack coming on. Only 5 times I felt the beginning of it. And I just got it away. God, 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 God. I just walk up and down to saying God, and it's gone. What is this but a miracle of healing? Are we not the luckiest people in the entire world? And thank you for having me here.